March the 30th, 2005, and we are here for a public hearing and work session on House Bill 5071, the Treasurer. We have an opportunity this morning for public testimony, and I believe that there is a sign-up sheet out. I would invite anyone interested in testifying to sign up. We're going to have the presentation of the Treasurer's budget, and with that, I'm going to open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 5071. Welcome the Treasurer and Ms. Haglund.
If I may, Madam Chair.
Please.
Yesterday I passed out materials to you, and there was a cover memo. I have given you a new copy right in front of you, an updated memo. There was a typo on there that the Treasurer staff was kind enough to point out.
Don't you hate it when that happens?
Well, I just love to be proven fallible.
$2 billion mistake. Right?
Actually, it was in the FTE in the very back table there. I had the wrong FTE in the back table, but all other stuff was it. So.
Good. Well, we have just started. Gavel there. So good morning to everybody. And would now invite the Treasurer to make any opening comments. What I hope to accomplish today, Mr. Treasurer, is to get some additional comments from you about your budget, to respond to any questions from the panel, to review your performance measures and hopefully act on those and move those forward to the co-chairs. And then time allowing to actually go ahead and do the work session on your budget.
Great. Thank you.
So that's sort of the lineup for this morning. So if you'd like to make some preliminary remarks, we'll forge ahead.
Well, this will be a joint presentation, and I'll just make some very broad opening remarks. Again, thank you for having us. My name is Rand Ledward, State Treasurer of Oregon. What we'll do is we'll give you a little more detail about our budget requests, and as your phase two presentation requires, a little more of background on some of the things that affect our budget and our operations. I want to go back and say that I'm extremely proud of this organization, as I think you should be as well. We have time and time again proven that we can run a business for Oregon, and we run it very, very well. We provide that financial infrastructure for the state. We provide a variety of services to local governments. We offer citizens an investment tool to help them save for college. We provide advisory services to the legislature and the governor on policy matters that can impact the state's financial picture. Behind me are the people who make this happen. The Treasury has a dedicated staff, the professionals. They're serving you and the state extremely well. We do work in a very sophisticated financial market as well as economic markets, which impact us. And I know this is one of the issues you're looking at are what are some of the budgetary drivers and the environmental factors that impact us. Since I've been treasurer, issues crop up all the time that we hadn't seen before. For example, the issue around corporate governance, the companies that we invest in, the markets we invest in, the collapse of Enron, the scandals at WorldCom and Tyco all impacted us, both in terms of affecting our bottom line and the investments we had made, but also raised new questions about our role as an investor and making sure that as an investor we were more prudent, if you will, in looking at our proxies and how we were voting them and demanding some change in the marketplaces that we operate and the companies that we invest in. And in fact, we're going to be asking later on to come back to the e-board to look at a position for us to help us with many efforts that are happening nationally in having investors being more proactive, if you will, in investments around corporate governance as well as the markets that we work in.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you, Mr. Treasurer. Are you working with other state treasurers then to review companies? I remember something about Safeway Corporation at one point. Could you comment on some of your investment strategies, please?
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, yes, this has been a group effort by treasurers and other large institutional investors, private and public, to work both in terms with regulators, working with Congress. There was testimony on behalf of Sarbanes-Oxley as far as reporting requirements. We have worked as a group of treasurers to improve disclosure by the mutual fund industry to try to drive disclosure out for investors so that people, citizens and large investors, have a clearer picture of what they're buying. We were very concerned about what happened with some of the the way in which Wall Street has been acting at the New York Stock Exchange, for example. Number of traders went back and talked to the board of executives there, or directors, about how they needed to improve their operations so that people had confidence. Yes, we have a very active in role, and I think responsibility in terms of using the $61 billion that are behind the state treasurer's office and ensuring that we have good companies that we can invest in, that there's more accountability to investors and to the public. And that's really a role that has become a lot more important, I think, for all investors, large and small, that you've seen across this country.
Thank you.
Certainly the collapse the last couple of 3 years of the markets as well as the economy certainly have impacted us, the state's budget. We've been confronted with, for example, a lowering of our bond rating as a result of some structural problems that we've had and continue to struggle with. We, as you know, I think there's going to be a question about the CAN program we set up. We've been needing to find a new way to manage a cash flow that hadn't been before us. So, again, macroeconomics as well as budgetary matters do impact us.
Actually, Mr. Treasurer, as long as you've raised the issue of the TANs, could you speak to that in a little more detail, specifically the interest expense on those TANs and how they're going to be treated?
Sure.
I'm sorry, this is an acronym-free zone, yes, and I followed your bad example into using an acronym.
We're not talking about tanning. We're talking
tax anticipation notes.
No, thank you, Madam Chair, for clarifying that. I know there's an interest by this committee and the legislature about where we should book the interest on these notes that we issue. It's our feeling that it would be best to book this against revenues and the revenue projections of the state. It would give us that more flexibility when we go out in the marketplace to sell these. We want to find the lowest cost way to do that. We believe, and there are others who can give you more detail as to why that rationale works for us, but we feel that's the most important place to put the expense of these TANs.
How will that debate unfold, and who will be all the players? I'm not arguing with your assessment that that's the best place, the best methodology to consider it, but I just am curious how the debate will unfold, eventually arriving at a conclusion.
You have more background on that, Linda?
Actually, if I may just jump
please
in.
Please, identify yourself for the record, if
for
you
the
would.
Record, Linda Haglund, Deputy State Treasurer. There have been some discussions ongoing between LRO, controlling the forecast, LFO, and DAS as far as where that should be booked. And there are some alternatives out there. The actual decision of where that would be outside of Treasury's control. Our input into the process is how do we get to the market the most at the least cost. And our feeling is that the offset against revenue on the forecast, as the Treasurer's indicated, is the least expensive way to do it. In discussions with Dallas and the rest of the group, our concern is that whatever mechanism is chosen, that the interest expense and income, all parts of it, are accurately reflected on the financial statements. And our feeling with it being against the forecast is that is updated quarterly, so there's going to be an ability to have the freshest both revenue forecast and cash flow and interest expense forecast. So really it comes back to the decision, I think, is going to be in your hands as far as where that's going to happen.
Okay. Thank you very much. Please continue.
Sure.
I apologize. Senator Morse.
Just a question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Can we rest these TANs, the tax anticipation notes, on a biannual basis, or do they become evergreen?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, they are 13-month notes is the maximum term, and that is actually in IRS restriction. So we, during the 18-month biennium, we do have to pay them off. So generally, with the cash flow projections that we have right now, we do actually sell two TANs during a biennia. Typically, we'll go out as soon as we can after the end of the close of session, and then the new biennia starting, issue a 13-month note, and then have a a shorter note that will last until the end of the biennium, be paid off prior to June 30th.
Well, these the term is short term, but in practical application, do we just continue to roll these?
Yes, I mean, at this point, yes.
So my question is, where do we cross the line in violation of our constitutional requirement that we're not balancing current expenses with borrowing long term?
Actually, can I expand on that, Madam Chair, Senator Morse? In a sense, they're rolled only because of the current condition of the general fund, in that during the biennia, you do start with a beginning balance, but then during the biennia, and as we've seen for the last couple and probably for the next few, we are going to be, or the general fund will be, in a negative cash flow position, meaning that it will be expending, its expenditures are at a faster pace than revenues are received. You do have an ending balance at the end of the biennia, so you have to come back to a balanced budget. So from that standpoint, we borrow and then it goes back to zero, but then we borrow again. So when the treasurer indicated that they roll, that's not technically correct. They actually are paid off. We come back to zero, and then we start anew. And it isn't debt from the standpoint of a debt limit impact, because they are paid off prior to the end of the biennia, so they do not cross the biennia. And to be very clear, this isn't financing operations. It's a working capital mechanism. Up to this point, when the general fund, or I should say a few biennias ago, when the general fund would be short of cash, again, because of the mismatch of timing of revenue receipt and expenditures, we were able to finance that out of the short-term fund on a short-term basis. When the amount got too large, too deep of a hole, and for too long of a period of time, we were not able to do that. So we needed to have a different mechanism, which was TANs. So that's a different financing mechanism. Additionally, TANs are sold in the tax-advantaged market versus paying a taxable rate of interest for the borrowing. So it's a way for the general fund to actually pay a lower cost to finance that shortfall during the biennium.
Just can you follow up if I may? I recall Treasurer's presentation last session that, as I recall, we're in new territory that we've not been in historically with these tax anticipation notes, and essentially working capital financing. Where do you see this going? I mean, talk about the structural issue of our state and the stability of our financing, and where this could lead us if we dropped into another serious recession.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, and we'd be happy to give you more information. I know we have a nice chart that we actually every day watch the state's cash flow, and we can show you historic trends as well as what's happening today with cash. We've had cash imbalances in the past. That isn't new. I think what's new is the size of the imbalance, and it goes to something I know you're very interested in, is they're related, and that is that we've had over time the revenues in the state have been out of balance with the demands in the general fund on huge swings. Partly that was the adoption of Measure 5 in schools, and when we paid schools, there was a large hole, if you will, in the cash flow of the state to pay out to schools. As the recession hit us very hard, that drove obviously our revenues down, and the hole got bigger. And in fact, we were at such cash imbalances that the reason why we came to the legislature to ask for this tax anticipation note authority was that we couldn't continue to borrow against the cash, the money that we had. It was too big, and it was more expensive, more importantly. And so going out to the market made more sense. One of the sort of the trends that has happened over time is not only have the cash imbalances gotten larger, and in this case we've not been in the cash positive without these borrowings,
We've been typically going into the negative in larger ways. We also, as we come back to the beginning of the next session, we have no ending balance. And that has been another challenge for the state. Over time, our ending balances and our general funds have become zero for the most part, in which case, when we start that cycle again every 2 years, we drop much off quicker. And so I know there's been an effort to figure out a way to make sure we have some ending balance. We used to. We drove this budget closer and closer to zero, and I know you're aware of that. And then as we went into these cycles and then the recession pushed us farther down, it's true. This recession is turning the corner. We're feeling that. I see, you know, in our revenue projections. But on a cash basis, we continue to have these cash deficits that point to a more of a structural problem that we have.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing this discussion.
I
just continue to have a grave concern about the lack of awareness in this body of what I perceive to be a very serious structural deficit in the way that the demands on resources that aren't there to sustain what we're being asked to do. And I think it's a very serious problem, and I think we'll likely end this session in a state of denial again, and hope that the future bails us out. But I don't want to belabor this point, but I think it's a very serious issue that we're not coming to grips with.
I share your concern and have thought, particularly as I was listening to this exchange, what forum you could elevate this discussion to that would capture not only the attention of this body but also capture the attention of the press. I think I share your opinion that this is very serious, and there seems to be a generalized lack of awareness.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I know you've got a cartoon that I believe illustrates this point well, of that the donkey and the horse, and they're laboring post Measure 5 and other initiatives that have been passed. And I think part of the awareness is to let the public know what we're trying to do, what you're trying to do, is afford a government that they've asked us to pay for with a tax system that hasn't been able to keep up. The recession was just was sort of the ending of a period of time which Oregon had a great run in the economy, but as we all have been watching the projections, that's not coming back to that degree. The tax system hasn't changed, and the needs are just as great as they are. So that goes to that structural problem you're talking about.
Senator Morrison.
Thank you. You mentioned TAMS, T-A-M-S, a different. Did you mention
slip of the tongue? It's
a slip of the tongue.
That's an N.
Well, I know you're talking about TANS, and then I thought you switched gear, but everything that you said was in regard to TANS.
Okay. Tax anticipation.
Yeah. Okay. I got that. Okay. Good. Well, I was afraid I missed something. Good.
Any other questions, Representative?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Treasurer, I appreciate the response to my inquiry from Inga in your office regarding your annual report. Do you have your annual report here? You have a copy of it with you? Okay. Well, I need some clarification on a couple of things that are in the report here. Your domestic equity fund obviously did very well. Many of your funds have done extremely well, 32% returns, 45% returns. Those are, you know, extraordinary, no doubt about it. I was just curious, what kind of a return overall were you able to produce in the Common School Fund? Do you recall what that was? Because the report doesn't actually give us a percentage return. Do you know offhand what that
was? 2004.
Yes. Is it anywhere close, Madam
Chair? It's a positive number.
I know that. I know that. Compared to what we had in prior years, I understand the relevance of that. But,
I apologize. We'll just...
Actually, we do have a number.
Go ahead.
For 1 year ending 12/31/04, 11.73%. Percent, and that's the total return of the account.
Okay. Madam Chair, if I may,
please.
If you're able to achieve a 32.7% in your domestic equity fund for 03. Okay. Why wouldn't you aggressively invest the why wouldn't you try to achieve the same return for the common school fund?
Madam Chair, Representative Kropp, each of the funds that we manage have an investment strategy around them. The trust fund for the pension fund is a different type of investment strategy than in a client than the common school fund. We have used outside experts, if you will, to help us model the portfolio around what's the best investment strategy for the returns that we're trying to achieve in the common school fund. Part of what we're trying to achieve in the common school fund is a balance where you're seeing both a bond and stock strategy that one helps smooth out variations. And so it's trying to compare the two strategies isn't quite appropriate. And secondly, I think looking at this, we have had a very good return short-term and long-term with the common school fund, and we're able to, in fact, provide additional money from last year because of that strategy. The thing that we don't do is chase return. That is, change investment strategy given stocks go up over a period of time, then suddenly just pull everything out of bonds and put it in stocks. You want to have a very disciplined portfolio, stick to that strategy. And the key to this has always been, in all of our funds, is rebalance. That is, making sure that when stocks start to grow and we have a target within what we want to keep the amount of stocks we have invested for all these funds and bonds, and in the case of the PERS fund, real estate and international stock and bonds, direct equity, is that when we see the marketplace increase the value in stock, for example, that at some point we take money out of that asset category and put it into bonds so that we're rebalanced. It sounds counterintuitive, but long-term, not trying to bet on which market's going to do better that year has paid off extremely well for the state and our clients.
Madam Chair, help me then understand why you wouldn't use the same criteria for the domestic equity fund, which returned 32% in 03.
Well, first off, I'd have to go look and see what the number we gave you was for 04.
Right. So I'm quoting off of your document that was provided by your office to me. So I believe it's out of your treasurer's annual report, is at least what the letter from Angus says. So I don't disagree with a balanced approach to investment strategy. I think that's fine. I guess my question is why is a standard different that produces a higher level of return for one fund is different for another fund? And it seems to me that we should be maximizing to the greatest extent possible the returns that we can achieve for the common school fund for the very obvious reasons that you've stated, the ability to put money into the pot for education.
Yeah. Yes. Madam Chair, Senator Kropp, yes. If I could take that question. You're referring to, in the 03 end report, the domestic equity fund, which is a portion of OPERF.
Right.
So if I can continue on the comments that the Treasurer made relative to the strategy within the common school fund of a balance between stocks and bonds, it is the same thing in OPERF. It has a portfolio that consists of multiple different asset classes for the same reasons of you don't want all your eggs in one basket. It helps smooth the returns over time, so you smooth out that volatility. For comparison, you're looking at purely the equity portfolio. We gave you the number for 2004 for the common school fund of 11.73. For comparison, the PERS fund in total, so a comparable number there, 14.47 was the PERS fund return. Your question, though, is well taken for the equity fund. And just as the Treasurer indicated, on a total portfolio basis, we look at having diversified asset classes. Within the equity portfolio, we also look at structure and have diversification there. So I believe the list you're looking at generically identifies managers by name. if we were to attach their role in the portfolio, you would see that there's managers that are buying large cap growth stocks, others focusing on large cap.
Right.
So it's the same thing. We have a diversified strategy within asset classes.
So then, Madam Chair, why would you not, if you, I go back to the people make phenomenal amounts of money every day in equities all across the world because they do chase the markets, because they're good at it. And if you're able to have segments of your funds that are able to achieve, and it says here, 5 out of 6 of the DEF small cap managers had returns greater than 46% in 2003, with the top performer returning 71%. Those are wonderful returns, and they're outstanding. So why wouldn't you move to a more aggressive standard, especially given to the issue that we're coming out of a recession and likely to see a return to valuation in the stock market and in equities?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, one of the pieces that we haven't talked about specific to the Common School Fund is distribution requirements. So there is that balance of the Common School Fund of the size of the fund itself relative to the payout to comp to the schools. Mm-hmm. This happens frequently during the year. So when you're managing an account that is not, in a sense, going to just grow, so it's only input and growth, inflow of funds and growth, but you actually have to realize and pay out funds, that causes you to actually have to realize investments. The investment manager, I can't speak to the one in particular, but you can get, if they're up 70% in 1 year, that's a manager that takes a very aggressive stance in the market, and there's an equal potential that on the next year they could be down 70%.
Agreed.
So the volatility. And if you're in the up, that's a great time to be liquidating assets from that manager to pay out to the schools. If you're down, that's a much larger hit to the portfolio.
Okay. Madam Chair, a couple more questions, if you would indulge me.
I will.
And then I'll be finished. The OPERF alternative equity investments, and again, I wish you had this document in front of you. I need some clarification. You have three columns here: total committee capital, investment cost, and realized value to date on these three. Could you share with me what the meanings of those three categories are?
Sure.
I'd like to bring up
definitions, perhaps.
My chief investment officer, if you shed light more on that, on those numbers, and perhaps help you with that last question you had about portfolio analysis.
I invite you to the table and ask you to give your name for the record, please.
Sure. Ron Schmitz, director of the investment division. So should I answer the return question first? Yeah. If there have been numerous academic studies as well as practitioner studies with respect to the issue of market timing, and the problem is it looks great after the fact, and it looks like it's something you should have been able to do, but you have to be able to do it in advance and make the market timing calls in advance, and there are just study after study after study that just show it can't be done. I mean, very, very few, if anybody, can do it. It can't be done consistently. And if I could give just a quick anecdote, if you go back to 1987 and the market crash then, there were numerous people that kind of felt they saw it coming. They got out of the market in mid-87 before Black Friday,
Tuesday, you're right, Tuesday. I remember it well, sadly.
and those that did, great, and were great. They crowed about it, and those that didn't kind of lamented the fact that they didn't make a market timing adjustment to their portfolios. The problem was that 6 months later, the market came roaring back. Most of the people that got out didn't get back in. So it's really two calls you have to get right, and the odds of getting even one of the calls right is very low. So for that reason, very few market professionals actually attempt to do that. The second point I guess I would make with respect to that, if you lined up the asset classes and just rank them by the best performing asset classes and segments within asset classes, and you did that over a period of years, you would see absolutely no consistency year to year. It's right. Not something that persists. And because of the difficulty in making those calls in advance correctly, most people just don't do it. Most investment professionals don't, and that's why we don't within the funds.
Well, Madam Chair, that actually makes my point. In that in your report, you talk about in 2002 that there were value stocks were beat growth stocks in 2002, and that the inverse of that happened in 2003, actually. And that actually gets to my point that if you see, you know, the old saying in the trading business is the trend is my friend. And so if you recognize a trend is going a particular direction, and typically the trends do not reverse within a few days, it typically establishes a trend for a pattern. It would seem to me that you would want to be able to readjust your thinking in terms of investment to take advantage of trends. And that would then lead you to some of the returns that obviously some of your portfolio managers were able to achieve in 2003, which is, again, quite impressive.
If I may, sure. I don't agree with that analysis. What I guess we were trying to point out is that we take a long-term approach to the marketplace, and so when we look at the PERS fund, I want to go back to the PERS fund and the Common School Fund. We do maximize returns for the Common School Fund, given the investment strategy, given the amount of money that we have, given the approach that we've taken. We have done a very good job. What you keep citing, Representative Krupp, is specific money managers within another portfolio, which is, again, geared for a different type of investment strategy. It is a much larger portfolio. We have the luxury, because of its size, to branch out and have more active management. In fact, the entire Common School Fund is a passive approach. It's indexed both at the bond and the stock market and international. So what we're trying to get at here is that it's not quite accurate. I can say it's not really accurate at all to try to reflect one manager's return versus one portfolio's return and that strategy out of two different portfolios. There is a cost element to this that we try to manage as well to make sure that we have the lowest cost, the highest return. It isn't that we're not trying to be not making money for the Common School Fund or the PERS Fund. We have been, and it's a long-term strategy. Trends come and go. And I think as Ron was just describing, when the stock market went this way 3 years ago, and it had three consecutive down markets, the bond markets were doing really well. And so as a result, we were able to counterbalance that by not moving a strategy all, you know, I mean, and then when the stock market came back, because of our position, without changing our asset allocation, we were able to ride that wave back up. You could criticize that maybe we could have gotten higher if we tried to run in time, but that, as the point was made, you can't time it both ways, when to dump and when to invest. And if you are, you're probably doing something illegal.
Ask Michael Milken.
One more follow-up, Representative, and then I'm going to exercise the prerogative of the gavel and move us on.
Explain to me total capital committee investment cost and realized value, because I'm looking at some funds that have done extraordinarily well and some where we put $300 million into Texas Pacific Gas Partners. Investment cost was $200 million. And the realized value is $83 million. And there's a whole host of those. Some are really good. Some don't look so good. So explain what those are to me, if you would, please.
Sure. Representative Krupp, Chair Johnson. There are a couple of dynamics going on there. The committed capital is the amount of capital that the OIC dedicated to a specific fund.
That goes in initially, Madam Chair?
Well, no, it doesn't, and that was going to be my second point. So at one point in time, you commit $300 million, to use your example. That gets drawn down over a period of usually 5 years is the investment period in these funds. So then the drawn down capital, the second column, I know exactly what the heading is, but that would be
investment cost.
So that would be the capital drawn down and actually invested then in companies within the fund invests in.
and then the realized value is I think pretty self-explanatory. That's the investments or what the investments are worth at a given point in time. The real dynamic here and why you see the big differences, there are indeed differences fund to fund, and some are more successful than others, but the real dynamic that doesn't come through in this kind of a snapshot is that some of those funds are early in their investment cycle. A fund that was just done in 2004, for example, is going to have more cost and less profits than a fund that was invested 5 years ago. And what you've got there is a mix, a whole array of funds that are some as many as 10 years old and very close to fully harvesting everything, others that are very new and just starting to invest.
Actually, Madam Chair, that's quite correct. Your KBR funds from 80, 82, 84, 86... $90 million invested now is worth $740 million. Those are, again, very good returns. Just so I can recap, so I understand, Madam Chair, for my own edification.
Remember, Representative, you're working off a document that none of the rest of us have.
I understand.
And I'm going to move on in a minute.
Okay. So just so I understand, total committee capital is what you intend to invest. The investment cost is actually what has been invested to date. And then the realized value is what it is worth today.
Correct.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Treasurer.
Good morning.
Good seeing you.
How are you?
Good. That was at a level that's far beyond my capability. I understand dollar cost averaging and making sure every month some money comes out of my checking account into my little retirement account. The question I have, though, and I've heard Senator Morris ask these questions in the past, and I think it'll help me. I assume you folks get audited. There's an audit function. Can I get a copy of the management letter and a copy of the response to the management letter?
And I'm sorry, I was hearing this. So is this a
I'm sorry. These type of questions are beyond my capability to manage.
Do you need a clarification, Ms. Hagelin, to respond?
Yes, please.
Would you restate your request, please?
You bet. From my perspective, the Oregon State Treasury does a very good job. But I obviously don't know the right questions to ask. I don't know how to interpret the information that's provided to me. I'm a loan officer. I'm not a financial analyst at this scale. But I do understand how to read management letters. Could any management letters that have been provided as part of audits conducted, can I receive a copy of those and then your response to those management letters?
Yes, and Madam Chair, as a result of our prior hearing, there was a question about audit reports, and I believe, has the professional staff?
We've distributed it already.
Okay.
So it's in that pile in my office that's this high.
Yes.
Thank you.
There were two separate memos that were information that was passed out from members.
And Madam Chair, if I may, Representative Smith, when you have a chance to look through that, if that's not sufficient, let us know.
I'm sure it is. I just need to get to the pile on my desk.
Okay.
Do you have any additional comments? Okay. Great. All right. We've interrupted you now. If you can find your spot in your presentation, let's soldier on. And just so that everybody knows where we're headed, it's my intent to continue this discussion not much beyond 9:30, then take public testimony if there is any, then discuss and move forward the performance measures, and then actually work on the budget. And I know that Senator Morris has some questions about the growth account, and so let's move forward.
Okay. Why don't I then, if I may, Madam Chair, jump in, and Dallas, you have provided our document this morning. Okay. What you have in front of you then is actually the information.
Let's make sure everybody's with you, Ms. Hagelin.
Okay.
Punch.
Titled Ways and Means Phase 2 Presentation and dated March the 30th. Starts
Correct.
Out Treasurer's Comments.
Correct. And actually we've covered Treasurer's Comments and then that first bullet. So the format that we've used here is the information that you have requested per the co-chair's instructions. So we've just followed the instructions, and I'll just proceed through that at a very fast pace.
Please.
And look to you to stop me if necessary. So let's move to the second point, which is describe the major changes to the agency. What you see highlighted there is three items, impact to our budget adjustments in 03-05, a new program coming into Treasury in 1999, and then we've had retirement of key personnel. over the last several years. I won't comment in detail on those specifically, but collectively, we've been able to manage those changes within the agency through the increased use of technology. However, I should note that the agency itself is at a stress point, and we're actually starting to see more demand from customers for different services from us. And as the treasurer briefly touched on, we're starting to see the need for potentially increased staff to manage those tasks. And those are the kinds of things that we may need to come back to the e-board to discuss with you. We see things on the horizon. We're just not ready to actually present and make a request now. Moving on to the second question, you wanted to have us describe specific actions of the agency that contain costs and improve program delivery. I won't go into detail there. These are all the programs that we reviewed for you in our Phase 1 presentation. A couple of them I'll highlight just very quickly. Additional internet services I highlighted back in our Phase 1 presentation, the rollout of statements over the internet, which has been received very well by our customers. Under new financial tools, stored value cards, that was the pilot program that we had with Employment Department that's looking to save them $2 to $2.5 million biennia. Again, that was House Bill 2030. I'm doing a little lobbying here. The House side has passed it, so now it's over on the Senate side, so we look for your support there so more agencies in the state can take advantage of that tool. With that, those are items in the past. What's noted there is future actions on claim property, investment, and debt management issues. We see on the horizon there's unclaimed property is being looked at, moved from Department of State Lands into the Treasury for a number of advantages to the program, better management of it through the financial expertise that's resident in Treasury that will be able to apply to the program, as well as we were mentioning just earlier about new services being asked for from our customers on the investment side and debt management. An example on the investment side is we have a number of customers looking for an ability to invest longer term, and so we're trying to come up with a short-term, short-duration bond fund for them.
Ms. Hagman, let me move back to the unclaimed property moving mm-hmm. from Department of State Lands mm-hmm. to Treasury.
Mm-hmm.
Will this increase your physical space requirements? How exactly is this transition moving? Frankly, I'm very supportive of it, having heard the Department of State Lands budget last session and realizing that there were some management issues there. Fill us in a little more detail how the discussions are moving forward. Is this the subject of legislative action or negotiation with the ESO?
There's Madam Chair, there was a bill that passed, had its first hearing yesterday. It's about that thick. It's amazing trying to move one function of government to another, but it was a very we've been working very closely with the Department of State Lands. This has been a land board initiative. The governor, Secretary of State, and myself, working with Ann Hannis, had decided that this was aligning that function would be better here in the state treasury. And in fact, nationally, this has been a trend because they really are a financial function of trying to match people's assets that have been discarded or lost, if you will, like safety deposit boxes, etc., to their owner. And so this has been a trend nationally. There is a bill. It had its first public hearing in the General Government Committee in the House. It will have a subsequent referral and perhaps a week before you, but it will require us to have some more physical space. We have almost the entire first floor of labor and industry right now. I think we've already begun discussions with how that those facilities about how we would incorporate that into the space that we have or may need a little more space, but that'll be a discussion. I don't know if you'll have that directly with this bill here, but if we do, we'd be happy to talk to you about the cost of it.
The piece that I recall from the state lands discussion of last session that was problematic was twofold. First of all, securing physical assets, and secondly, having the requisite expertise to dispose of some of those physical assets to maximize the return. And what kind of additional personnel stress will that put on your shop to be able to both take custody of the material in, say, a safety deposit box, and then to maximize the return?
Madam Chair, From the staffing side of it, the plan right now is that we would actually move the unclaimed property to division from state lands, which is 12 folks, and just actually pick them up and bring them into Treasury, and not make any substantive changes to the program at this time. More or less bring it into Treasury, get our arms around it, feel what's going on, see how we can leverage their needs against current staffing capacities within Treasury, how we can make realize some internal efficiencies, and then probably coming back in the subsequent biennium to be looking at any kind of program enhancements from an FTE standpoint. At this point, our view is that we aren't going to be needing any new FTE in the transfer.
I just recall from the discussion that there were some rather cumbersome processes in place with respect to dispatching folks from Salem to go physically secure assets, and it just seemed like a maladroit way of doing it. And I would commend for your consideration something a little more efficient and streamlined.
To that point, it's interesting. One of the things we've already noted is the difference between the IT support that they have at the department versus in our shop. As Linda described, we are so dependent upon technology to wire transfer, security needs. We have a very high level of infrastructure around our IT department. They already see how our IT can actually, excuse me, it's not it, but it's information technology, apologize.
I was giving you a pass.
I know. I'm sorry. It's early, I guess. But that we can really enhance the technology that can be utilized to get the information out and matching people. And a lot of technology is being used not only in that can be used in Oregon, but across the state to match people up with their property.
Thank you.
And if I may add to that, I don't want to leave the impression with the committee. The program has had some issues over the years, and they've made grand progress in improving processes and tightening up practices. And we see the move to Treasury as just furthering the program.
Right.
So
thank
they're
you.
In much better shape than they were a number of years ago.
Thank you very much. If you'd continue with your presentation.
The next question that you had posed actually was wanting us to comment on our private sector use for both efficiencies and delivering of agency services. And Treasury itself uses private services, professional services extensively, and we look to them to leverage our capacities. As an example, in our investment division alone, Representative Smith, in the pages that he's looking at, saw, thank you for the correction.
He's
gone. You can stay.
I'll move you to the other side on my next.
I appreciate
next.
That.
Okay. In the investment division, thank you. There's 183 relationships that are managed by the investment division. So investment managers, general partners, consultants, attorneys that work with us on the legal matters associated with those transactions. So those are all private sector relationships. Additionally, in the IT...
Let me stop you, Ms. Hagelin.
Yes.
And those are refreshed periodically at the instigation of your office or a failure to meet certain specified and agreed-upon targets, or what would cause there to be any modification in any of those relationships?
Yes, Madam Chair. On the investment side of the transaction, those are all relationships that are approved by the Oregon Investment Council, so it's the implementation of that. They are depending on the transaction. So, for instance, our public equity managers, one of the lists that was being looked at, are monitored on a regular basis and are terminated if performance doesn't meet benchmarks. On the partnership side, those are a much longer-term investment, and you don't have the opportunity to exit them quite as easily. So our opportunity to actually make a change is when we have a choice of reinvesting with the partnership in a follow-on fund or not. And I hope that was responsive. If I may continue.
Please.
Just to add to that, all of our relationships are at will. So
correct.
For a variety of reasons, we can terminate that within, is it 90 days, is built in, or 60 days?
Most of them, some are actually 30.
The mm-hmm. point is, we're not
beholden to anybody that we hire. And I think that's an important point, that if there's a lack of performance, and unlike those numbers you cited, there are others who do lose money, and if at some point they cross a threshold, we will put them on a watch, and if they continue to underperform, we'll terminate them. And that's part of our job, is to make sure we have a good mix of managers and the performance.
Great. Can we move on? Thank you. The next item that you asked for was to comment on major budgetary issues of the agency, and again, I don't want to be redundant. We've already touched on the two items that were highlighted there. We're seeing potential staffing needs in the future, and then, as we mentioned, the move of unclaimed property to Treasury should that legislation be successful. The next item was to have comment on budget detail of the agency, and I'm actually now on page 3 of your memo. I want to stress that Treasury's budget is 100% other funds, and the 2005-07 governor's budget is set up to continuing the existing services of Treasury, all of those that were reviewed in Phase 1. So to be clear, while we're talking about unclaimed property does not figure into this budget whatsoever. It's current Treasury services. And with the time, I'll look to the chair. Would you like me to go through the adjustments or? I can do it very quickly.
If you can do it quickly, at least it would set the stage then for our recommendation later.
Okay. All right. What you're seeing then in that table is our governor's budget, and I'll just highlight the changes. The adjustments to the budget under personal services, the PERS rate reduction, that's a reduction in our budget due to PERS rates going down. The second item, the PICS freeze adjustment, we had actually three positions that were open and being recruited for during the PICS freeze event. And so these are adjustments to our salaries to bring them in line with the actual hiring of those positions versus what was locked in the PICS freeze. Position reclass, the treasurer touched on that briefly. We have a vacant FTE in the agency that we're looking to assign some legal review tasks in the investment division so we can work more closely with our investment managers and with Department of Justice and try to be more efficient and effective in those actions. This is reclassing that position from its current classification in the finance division, moving it to the investment division and bringing it up to that standard. Under services and supplies, you see under the POP package 030, which is the inflation adjustment, there was an error on BAM's side when they made that 030 program adjustment, and we worked with BAM to make that correction, and it related to just how they treated some professional services, the mechanism that works in our budget. So they're in agreement with that adjustment, as is Dallas. And then the last item, increased agency program-related S&S. This is under the non-limited aspect of our budget. This pays for investment-related expenses as well as our banking expenses. And this would true up our agency requests for 05-07 to be reflective of the cost that we see will be in our budget actually through the end of this biennium. So it's refreshing the number up to what we see we're going to be needing in the next biennium. I don't know. I'd like to make a placeholder here, Madam Chair, for the non-limited. I know that the professional staff is making a recommendation of how that be treated, and it be treated differently going forward. So the agency doesn't agree with that, and I would like to make you aware of our position there. It might be more appropriate to do that in work session if that would be your preference.
I am going to rely on the professional staff to give me a little guidance. Having not had the benefit of the full conversation, I'm not even quite sure where you are. I apologize for having to step out of the room.
Great.
It's not limited.
Go ahead, please, okay. Dallas.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, not only with respect to the Treasurer's budget, but with a number of budgets, there's included in them what is called non-limited other funds expenditure limitation. It means it's not subject, the legislature sees it in the budget request, but in the budget bill itself, there's an exclusion then for those types of expenditures for being subject to expenditure limitation. The numbers are presented, but then these monies are continuously appropriated, and then if they need to spend more, if more money's coming in, they just go to budget management and get an increase in the allotment, and the legislature basically is given approval for them to do that outside of the without getting additional legislative approval for the expenditure limitation. We are kind of a policy or a practice this by any means because of interest in moving more from non-limited to limited, where we see that there is some, it's an operational issue. And so this is requiring agencies to go back and maybe sharpen their pencils a little bit and their calculations. This may require additional return to the emergency board in the event that certain of these costs go up and many of them are demand-driven. If they go up and they see that they'll need additional limitation, then they'll have to come forward to the emergency board. So it may increase the number of visits that the emergency board has to entertain by agencies. But you will see this adjustment being proposed by the Legislative Fiscal Office just about in every subcommittee. And a great number of budgets.
Ms. Hagman, do you have a comment?
Yes, I do, Madam Chair. And I would agree with the professional staff on the function of the non-limited. I would want to stress, though, that specific to Treasury, all of the expenses that we run through non-limited are outside of our control. It's investment-related expenses and banking expenses. Investment-related expenses would be items that of the investment council's action, hiring a new consultant, something that we have to then implement based on their decision. On the banking side, it's a straight pass-through of just the volume of checks that come through or transactional activity. It's a direct pass-through of that cost. We have no control over the number of items that are used. Couple of examples out there. On the unemployment trust fund, they don't know how many people are going to be drawing benefit checks. The actual payment of that is a non-limited expenditure. I'd highlight that is non-limited. The actual payment of those transactions, though, flows right through our budget, non-limited. Another example would be PERS, their benefit payments. They have no idea of how many people are going to retire. And therefore how many checks are going to be generated. That's a non-limited expenditure. Those checks themselves run through our systems. So that is our belief why that is still appropriate for those expenditures to be held under non-limited. I'd also highlight that we have used non-limited for many, many, many biennia. And in the 99 biennia, we came back to the legislature and reconfirmed the use of those expenditures for banking and investment-related purposes such that we could be responsive to the actions of the board and changes in the market and our customers. And we believe that's still true.
Mr. Weiner.
Yep, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We would agree that the payment of benefits out of the Unemployment Insurance Fund and the PERS retirement system would be non-limited. Those are trust fund payments, but the cost of processing those payments, if you will, we think should be under limitation, and that's where the checks go. No.
And that will be part of your recommendation in the budget report?
Yes, ma'am.
Madam Chair, just a difference of opinion, and we would say while the payment, there's no control, we have no control over that actually hitting our system.
I mean, I think that this is an efficiency point, I think, that we're trying to make, and you know, I know there's an overarching concern about non-limited, and I think that's obviously something the legislature needs to continue to monitor and discuss. I think we're making a business case as to why we've historically had this non-limited and how we've used it, and I think we always try to make sure we're not over-inflating it or under-inflating it, just try to keep, for efficiency points of view, that we're not coming back every 2 months or however often review board is there to do some financial work, which we may have to put on hold until we got approval. I know there's maybe a bigger policy question you're asking, but I think we can give you an example as to why it's important for our operations to make sure that we can work efficiently, and that's why it's been in place for us for years.
And at this point, when the budget report comes forward, your recommendation... Go ahead.
My recommendation, Madam Chair, would be to remove... actually, it would be an amendment to their budget bill in Section 2, which would remove the exclusion from expenditure limitation for those expenditure things. And then for the budget report, it would show it as moving from non-limited to expenditure limitation.
It may be that we'll have the opportunity to continue this debate moving forward. I am not sure at this juncture whether or not we're going to be able to complete action on your budget today, and so this may continue to be a point of professional disagreement and dialogue as we move towards the actual completion of your budget. Please continue, Ms. Hagelin.
I'm sensitive to our time limit. And I am almost completed. The last thing to highlight again on the table, more or less, that you see on page 3 is the program option package 101. This is specific to our college savings network program. We are asking for limitation for additional professional services of $700,000, and this is actually for marketing of the program. It's a program that clearly needs to have its success is dependent on getting the word out there. These dollars, I might add, have been resident in the vendors. So it's been expended at the vendors. We're bringing it under our control, which allows us to obviously have more control of those dollars and also control where they're spent.
What kind of new marketing tools are you going to use? I notice we get closer to tax day, the frequency of your ads increases with the little fat piggy bank, and I just wondered what other tools you're going to be able to use. They're very effective, very provocative ads.
You know, and Madam Chair, good question, and actually they are effective because they're out there and our contributions and calls increase. You're not going to see functionally a difference in the program. The same types of tools that are being used will continue to be used. Maybe we'll freshen up an ad. But again, I just want to stress that these are dollars that the program has had available to it to date, but they have been held at the vendor versus being in our...
And I make no criticism of the ads. I think they're very easily understandable and they're provocative, and certainly as the hot breath of April the 15th is on all of us, they would cause one to ruminate on one's opportunities prior to that date.
If I may move on, Madam Chair.
Please.
The last item on that that POP is the reclass of the support staff to the program, and really that's just a reflection of the development, the growth of the program, and the services that that individual needs to perform. The new classification better reflects that skill set.
Why is that reclassing it to zero then?
Same salary level.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Right.
Thank you. Thank you.
You had the final question. Two questions. Ending balance was relative to our position, and you can see we've noted there on your page 4. We keep 2 months ending balance, 2 months working capital balance on an ongoing basis. That may drop to a month or go up to 3 months. We think that's a prudent level of cash to have for our operations, given the ability of our customers to forward our fee assessments on a regular basis. Your final question was summary of proposed legislation. There's a number of bills out there that do have impact.
May I go? You have one long-term vacancy. That's
my apologies.
That's it.
We do, and that's actually the position that we're moving and going to use for this legal work in the investment division.
Okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
Correct. If I may continue.
Please.
The last question then was on legislation outstanding impacting the agency. There's a number of bills out there, the ones that we think probably have the most direct impact and are in the works are the three that I've highlighted there. Unclaimed property, allowing Treasury to invest in equities directly and the collateral pool bill.
Any questions on this portion of Ms. Hagelin's presentation? All right, then I think what we'll do is to open it up to some other more generalized questions in areas off of your presentation materials. I know that Senator Morris wants to engage in a discussion of the growth account, and I would invite you to bring your question forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for sending this material. Very, very
thank
helpful.
You.
The way the statute reads, you have the responsibility to declare earnings in the account, and I wondered if maybe if we could address the summary that you gave us on this little spreadsheet. If you have that.
Which binder is that?
Is it in the binder?
Well, you sent it, it by a separate one that had the pretty flowchart on it.
Oh, okay.
And, Ms. Hagelin, was this material provided to the entire committee?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it's the one that was presented by Kate Cooper Richardson.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Signature. Yes,
on March 23rd.
Good. All right.
And after one, why don't you come up just for efficiency?
Thank you very much. And, again, I would ask you to state your name for the record as you join the panel.
Ron Schmitz, Director of the Investment Division of Oregon State Treasury.
And the question is, do we have earnings to declare?
Depends, I suppose, to a certain extent, Senator Morris, on how you define earnings. There have been earnings within some of the funds, but as a total portfolio, we're actually in an unrealized loss or a loss position at this point in time.
Maybe you could shed some light on, if you would, call up Madam Chair.
Please.
Fair market value and returns of capital versus the invested commitments.
I think the relative comparison, Senator Morse, is the called capital versus the two columns you referred. Called capital by the funds we invest in is just over $20 million. The current fair market value or returns of capital is at $16 million, representing you're showing a loss of $4 million. I think this is very highly dependent on the time frame by which these investments were made. The bulk of the investments in the fund at this point in time were made in the 99-2000 time period, which is kind of a high watermark for private equity pre-bubble. So that, you know, subsequent to that very short order, you know, the market crashed, as I'm sure you're well aware, and that had an influence on the value of these private equity investments as well. If you were to look at for example, in OPERF that we were talking about earlier, some of the funds that were in mid-90s, you know, would have very positive results. And so the difference is really reflective of market conditions. Not that this portfolio necessarily is worse than the other, per se, but relative to the market and the time frame it was invested, it has performed worse.
Just please continue as long as you'd like.
Thank you. That pretty well sums it up, I guess. If there aren't any earnings to declare, we'll have to be patient, I guess.
May I just elaborate on what Ron said, Madam Chair? This fund was started in 1999. I think that vintage year, for whether it's in the ODA, first fund, any that vintage year, that is the year in which we started investing, can show to be a very challenging one. Well, subsequent to that, and really, it's only been in the last couple of years that we've been able to begin to put more money out to new people. And one of our strategies is long-term is to, one, spread out our investments over time so you don't have, as we were describing about market timing, I think if anybody could have foreseen the bubble breaking, 99 was not the year to start a fund. And there are a lot of bodies around because of that. But what we're trying to do is patiently put money out to new folks in different years with different strategies that so that we do have a return. But it will take time, and I want to underscore the commitment, the drawdown that Ron was talking about earlier. That's just taking money out of these partnerships. They're putting money in. It can take years. It can be 7 to 10 years before you actually see those investments realized, positive or negative. I mean, and I want to put this out, obviously investing is risky. There's risk inherently in both in bodies that you're going to have investments that don't fly. And the net is you hopefully have people who will have more net positives than net negatives. And that's just the way this works. And I think, you know, we're beginning to show a larger portfolio, a broader investment strategy, and it will play out for work.
Would I read this spreadsheet correctly to the effect that we have about $270 million that is not committed to any venture fund?
No.
One account says total fund size $314 million.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, that actually I think is a really interesting position to look at. The $314 million is the total funds that each of those fund managers were able to raise. Some of that money was from the federal government through SBA loans. Some of that money was also leveraged with other private money. So you can actually see how $40 million leveraged roughly or helped leverage the $314 million. And that's the total amount of money these managers have at their disposal to invest. So I think, again, that points that this program actually is helping create more opportunity and money out there for investments in the state of Oregon and Northwest. Again, our portion is just the $40 million. That's
okay.
Our
okay, thank you. And just one last question. The reference in one part of the document is the purpose of the Oregon Growth Account is to earn returns for the Education Stability Fund. And I thought it was the Higher Education Technology Transfer Fund. Is there a misprint, or you're just talking about the broader umbrella of the Education Stability Fund, which includes the Higher Education Technology Transfer Fund?
Are you looking at?
Yes, that's the one I'm looking at.
It's
the broader scope.
Right.
I just want to make sure that I was not misreading it. So, thank you. That's all. Thank you.
This is an area that I have exchanged a number of letters with Ms. Richardson over in trying to understand what protections are in place with respect to these outside fund managers, particularly given the track history of the earlier account. And it has been stricken briefly from my memory, the ORTDA. And I am looking, I guess, at this point on the record, some distinction between ORTDA, their oversight and performance, and the amount of money that's now being managed and the oversight and performance. I would invite Ms. Richardson to the table.
Maybe I could just give you one snapshot. Just a brief history. This strategy was developed in the early 80s to take some lottery money and try to make direct investments in the state of Oregon.
This was the ORTDC.
Actually, it was ORTDC.
ORTDC.
Say that. There was another letter on there before. F. It had an F in there at one point. The point is there was a committee structure set up, and these folks would actually hear presentations to make direct investments. That's the way the initial structure was set up. It ran into a legal problem where that committee, when some of these investments, some of them failed, and some of them actually made it far enough that there was going to be an equity position that in fact this board representing the state was going to be able to take. The Attorney General's office said, you can't do that. The Constitution prohibits the state of Oregon owning equity in a company. So, So that kind of put the brakes on that model. Then came along the Oregon Growth Account, which was embedded in the Constitution when the Educational Endowment Fund was created. And that set up a model whereby we have a board, and I'm the chair, and we, just like we do with the PERS fund, find third-party managers who are out raising money and give them money, assuming they meet certain investment criteria and scrutiny. We do a lot of due diligence on them. We've turned down a lot of people who've come to our door and say, well, you're not quite there yet. And we give them money in that pot, which Senator Morris described is now $300 million if you look at how much this has helped leverage. So, and their job as third party is to go out and make the returns that they have committed to, not only to us, but to other partnerships. So that is a completely different model, and it's one that's worked extremely well for the PERS fund. We believe it's working well here. Unfortunately, we started in 1999. I think we're going to have a hard time in those early years to show that we've made a positive return, but I think, again, we've broadened our portfolio, the years, and the investment strategy, so I think we'll see the returns. And the economic development that was behind this was to, one, seed ideas, two, make sure those ideas that are solid are going through that same scrutiny that we've put the money through so that, in the end, it's a viable business.
Two follow-ups. That was very helpful. Thank you. The piece that I'm looking for reassurance on is in the early iterations of ORTDC that I thought was oriented towards technology, they ended up doing salmon farming and some other stuff that turned a lot of money into very little money. And I'm looking for reassurance that there are now adequate oversights, both in the quality of the investments and in the performance of the investments, that would cause you all to change managers if there were abnormalities or anomalies. And I'm just looking for that oversight assurance. And then the other thing that I want to touch on is the question of the seeding the ideas, because moving through this legislative session is a concept to provide funding in that area, I think, in the nomenclature of investment, the valley of death, from the proof of concept to some commercialization. Could you explain why it is that any of these funds couldn't speak to that level of investment or quality of investment?
Could I take that last part first?
Sure.
Actually, we do have a fund. Part of the Oregon Growth Account is dedicated to what you're calling seed capital. That's very, very early on investing, and it's largely targeted at our university system, which has been making great strides to take concepts and develop them commercially.
Which one of these accounts, if I can interrupt you, is principally doing that? Which one of your fund managers?
Northwest Technology Ventures.
Cool. Okay.
Can I interrupt really quick to feed into this?
Sure.
How do you take that concept, that seed, how do you take it out of the valley of death? Who's doing that?
Well, if I may, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, the firm that we hired them because they were going to spend the time and the money and the resource to look for ideas that they thought professionally had commercial viability. There are others they have brought with them to look at co-investing. Seed investing is really, really high risk. And that is, you're going to see a lot of these not fly. On the flip side, this is really starting to get into the economic development part of this.
Going in a moment.
The marketplace itself is not very efficient here. High net worth individuals, what we call angel investors, tend to play in this area. People on foundations and boards often will put money in this. But the market itself, there's not a very, let's just say, you can't find many people in the true marketplace that will go out and play in this.
And I didn't mean to.
For that reason.
But in, but this.
The net effect is the same, but please play through.
How come you're involved in this and not the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department?
Ms. Richardson, you look like you're going to pop. Would you like to join the panel?
I just wanted to.
Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Board of Kate Richardson, Oregon State Treasury Chief of Staff. And the timeline also that was provided in that packet with the Oregon Growth Account that talks about the ORTDA and its merging in 2001. That's the follow-up that brought that ORTDA under the auspices of the OGA and the Treasurer's Office, and it became a sub-account, and that is this group that we're talking about right now, too, is sort of...
How come you're doing it instead of economic development? Excuse me.
This early, Madam Chair, Representative, I mean, the early seed stage investing.
How come you didn't pass that over to the department, or why didn't What's the connection between you and economic development?
Well, in this case, the OGA was created through legislation to put under the treasurer's office, and given that model I described earlier of sort of a fund of funds, if you will, it seemed that the policy call was to put it here. The early seed stage was an effort, was it in the 2001 session, to try to fill in some money into that valley of death, if you will. And given the model that we had and the lottery money that pays for this program, that seemed to be appropriate. And that scrutiny.
Like you, excuse me.
Oh, go ahead.
Representative, do you like you do a good job doing it?
I think we're doing a decent job in a tough, you know, this is a very tough place. I think the people we've hired are doing a very good job. I think what they find themselves doing a lot is working on going around to the universities and literally working hand in hand with these folks and, you know, professionals. Just educating them is half the challenge. How do you take an idea? They're not thinking about commercializing it.
So what do you, follow up. So what do you think about Oregon Economic and Community Development Department deciding to become a competitor of yours and instituting their own program where they also want to seed startups of a similar nature?
Can you tell
$9 million.
Me which
pro- Onami.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Innovation Technology.
You want to speak to that?
I would say that the efforts, as you know, the treasurer sits on the Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development, OCED, and it's that group, the sort of all the same players around the table, that has brought forth a bill in this session to create Oregon Inc., the Oregon Investment Council, Innovation Council, and that is an effort to coordinate all these different alphabet efforts out there, and there would be an Oregon Growth Account representative on that council as well. Partly it's recognizing that there has been a scattered approach and there's an effort to make this more cohesive, so we have been working with them.
The next obvious question, and I'm going to preempt my colleague and friend, is why not consolidate it in your shop where you have a track record of doing this kind of work? Some of us are really grappling with the question of these little pockets of high-tech investment that is esoteric, sophisticated, complicated, risky stuff. Why have it scattered all over the place? Why not put it in your shop?
Are we ready to amend the budget? Is that what you're saying?
Why don't we bring Governor Cooley down and we'll put him here?
You two arm wrestle.
Yeah.
I will speak to one thing. I mean, we're a return-driven shop, and although the Oregon Growth Account, when it was created, was to earn returns. And it was placed there. It was an investment. We hire managers that specialize in different areas, and that's what we do. So that's why it was here. Does it have an economic benefit or economic development benefit? Yes. And in fact, you could look to the Oregon Investment Fund out of the out of OPERF, out of the PERS fund, as being a return-driven fund, but also having an economic development component, a secondary benefit. Now, that's not the primary purpose. And again, with the Oregon Growth Account, the primary purpose here is to earn returns. We hire specialized managers that do that. At the same time, we recognize there needs to be a coordination in this relatively small state in this area.
Can you expound on the coordination? Excuse me.
I think that is reflected in the Oregon Innovation Council development, sort of the evolution of the Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development, where it creates a council where with representatives from all these different areas, the Oregon Growth Account, the ETIP.
Can you send me a copy of the strategic plan
for
this group? The coordination. Well, I'm assuming there's a plan that's been put in place that shows this coordination between everyone.
I think that's primarily reflected at this point in the bill that's going through, which is Senate Bill 838, if I'm correct, and that's Senator Morse.
So I'm
follow
sorry,
up, Senator Representative Smith.
So we're going to ask for I'm just playing through this because you guys are part of OCED. We're going to ask for $9 million for innovation technology. You folks have something that could meet those needs. You're coordinating with this, and there's not a written strategic plan that you could present to us to explain how the two are going to work together?
My understanding, and I think actually Senator Johnson's going to also serve on Oregon Council for Knowledge and Economic Development, so I don't want to overspeak here, but the bill, Senate Bill 838, which would create the Oregon Innovation Council, in that would be primarily housed out of the OECDD, out of the Economic and Community Development Department, and they would have those documents or that vision, and we have copies of some of them that I can get to you as well.
I'm going to ask on behalf of the committee, just because I think it would be very instructive, to task you, Ms. Richardson, with getting that all rounded up from the two different agencies, making it available to the professional staff here so that we can pass it out to the whole committee. This is going to be an ongoing conversation that three of us will have in another Ways and Means sub, and a number of four of us, sorry, and a number of us have participated through the interim in the development of the OCED legislative strategy. We're going to be watching it very keenly, and I think some linkage points would be instructive. Thank you. Senator Morris.
What prohibition would there be other than just revising the statute? Is it constitutional to redirect the unfunded commitment of $20 million. And I look specifically at the almost $11 million that's in the Northwest Technology Ventures, which it seems to me that we're trying to put a square peg in a round hole, in that these are actual investments. And what we're talking about is a need for seed capital that predates an actual investment. It's a grant phase for proof of concept. And it seems to me like that maybe structurally this thing just isn't working, and it won't work for the intended purpose of you know, getting these principles and ideas from paper onto the bench and actually proven that there is a potential for commercialization. Now, is that $20 million, is that constitutionally directed, or is it statutorily directed? And I'm referring to this spreadsheet that you gave us.
The Oregon Growth Account itself is statutory. The Education Stability Fund is constitutional.
But some of that money, Madam Chair, Senator Morris, and I don't have a chart, that $20 million would also include... Once we've made a commitment through a contract, we can't. That's not
okay. Even though it's unfunded, even though it's unfunded, you can't pull those funds back
because we promised it. It's committed. Once committed, it's contractually obligated. So to do.
Okay.
If I might, just maybe throw a little more light on this. The Valley of Death, as you described. Is one that we at the OGA really take seriously, and I think if there's some ways to enhance that, that's really a positive. This is a fairly new piece for us, and when OGA was created, there was also another policy that was trying to be driven here, which is trying to expand the number of firms in the region that were investing in Oregon. Money begets money. And so for a great example is Smart Forest Ventures. They didn't exist before OGA. OGA gave them a roughly $6 million in commitment, and as a result of that early capital, they were able to go out and raise more money, and they have a fund that's roughly $25 million, but I know they've been able to leverage other money with that as well. So my point is part of the strategy here, too, was to try to incubate the Smart Forest approach. Tamarack's another firm that didn't exist until OGA. So there's another strategy here, which was to try to seed a little later stage investing with people who were putting money in Oregon in the Northwest that will benefit the state. And that was another strategy. The whole early stage, the whole seed stage, really started to evolve a few years ago with that early money with Northwest Ventures. I know OHSU has been working with them, and their foundation has looked at trying to match some money to make some early investing at OHSU. And I think we're still in our way there. If there's another structure that gives us some additional resources, or we can find somebody out there to manage some money in this area, we'll certainly do it. The problem has been there are not many money managers who will spend the time because the returns are very tough to get. It's very labor-intensive and time-intensive to go and spend time with researchers to work them through these things, which is really proof of concept, business plans. Early, I mean, you're talking about trying to help people write business plans, let alone see some commercialization of that, which is the later stage. What I do think, and I guess I'll conclude here, having the OGA under the Treasury with the Oregon Investment Fund, with the PERS Fund, we kind of have a continuum. I mean, we've really been able to sort of have an ability to drive over time. We will see, I believe. For example, I think Smart Forest, when they go back out for their second round, might be able to attach money to the pension fund versus the Oregon Growth Account. And so it's sort of a way to work people up as well into that large investment world that, which, again, would benefit Oregon.
Done, Senator Marsh?
We have Senate Bill 853, which is an attempt to identify sources of funding for all the need that predates what actually is going on here in the Oregon Growth Account. And we have worked mightily hard on that issue. So it'll be interesting to see. But I think it will be very compatible with eventually with the Oregon Growth Account.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. So often when people don't understand something, they speculate to the negative. And unfortunately, I don't understand. And I want to work through this with you, not today, but soon. Part of my frustration is four of us serve on another committee where we're trying to look at what can we do to stimulate the economy of Oregon. And I'm going to be real candid. Your counterparts haven't mentioned the role you folks play in this process. And to me, something's wrong with that. I'm going to ask for you folks to come join us in another committee as well and to walk through this. Part of this is going to be based on some fact, based on some emotion. This last year in Union County, we had a company where we had a gentleman retire from a Fortune 500 tech company, gave his pension away for the rights to a small little piece of equipment, took the patent, and they signed it over to him. County put thousands and thousands of dollars into it. Rural Investment Board put thousands and thousands of dollars into this. The city gave away everything they could give. We came to the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department thinking that's the natural place to go, and it was, we don't know what to tell you. I mean, there wasn't one mention of look into this. Now, how is it that we could have a small little project with all the potential in the world where everyone back in Eastern Oregon saw the value of this, from Judge Laura Pryor, which we all know, down to the commissioners, to myself and Senator Nelson, and yet we couldn't even get through the front door to get 5 minutes worth of time, not because of your fault, but because there was no connection to you. And so that's going to lead me to my negative question. And that is, I'd like to see how these dollars have been utilized by county, not by regions, not by Eastern Oregon and this. I'd like to know, starting from the largest county down to the smallest, how dollars have been allocated in each county. Please. And I know you folks you're the managers of that account. And I know there's a board, but nonetheless, I'm assuming this body has a little bit of say in how that's run. And so I'd like to know how that works, and I'd like to know the connections.
Thank you. In Lane County, is Metro Partnership involved? Are you familiar with that? You're not familiar with that?
They're not involved.
Okay.
Well, I think we're probably ready to move into performance. Unless there are other questions.
No, I think moving into performance measures is great. And I think what we're going to do, just so that everybody knows where we are, and Treasurer Edwards, you can plan ahead. We're going to finish performance measures today, move this over to probable work session tomorrow. And what I would like to ascertain, I think most of the faces behind you are all familiar faces to me, and they came with you. But has anyone signed up on the public testimony? Because I would invite public testimony at this juncture.
There's nobody in any church.
Okay.
And the way we've got it scheduled is public hearing and work session, so maybe we should go into a work session on the performance measures and carry over work session till tomorrow.
That sounds just dandy. So we would then close the public hearing on House Bill. Sorry, I've made so many...
5071.
Thank you. Okay, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 5071 and open a work session on the performance measures for House Bill 5071, the Treasurer of Oregon.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, the thing that I gave passed out to you yesterday afternoon is the codified performance measures. This is in the memo that I sent to you yesterday, the materials. And what the treasurer is going to do, remember, in the first phase, they had the performance measures displayed somewhat differently. This is the display that will be used in the budget report. So these are the common display. They've sort of summarized them very briefly.
Look at the
You're welcome to
well,
take
Well,
I gave it to you all.
I'll share with
you. Okay.
Okay.
It is a handout that has on the front.
I delivered to your staff yesterday, and it's a memo from my
committee. That's it. You just had it right there. That's
there
it.
All right. Set for Wednesday, March 30th.
Good.
I knew I had it somewhere.
Thank you.
Okay, and we are now turning to the display of the performance measures. Mr. Treasurer, I would invite any comment from you. As I recall, when we went through, these were all rated very high by the committee, and I would invite any opening comment from you before we begin deliberation moving towards approving these or modifying them and moving them forward.
I'll turn it over to Linda.
Ms. Haglund?
Madam Chair, the form itself is actually fully reflective of the measures that we presented to you in Phase 1. The only differences that you would see is we've cleaned up some of the titles. So there has been no additions or changes. This is what's reflected in our Phase 1 presentation.
Now, you have a number of these measures, do you not, that are under discussion by the Investment Council right now that may be subject to some change? Is my understanding correct? Are you nuancing any of these? Or
no. No, the measures that you're seeing specific, I guess it would be numbers 1 through 8.
I think what we're looking at is note 1, if I may. Madam
yes, please. I'm going to ask the professional staff to give us
a you have a number of notes on your targets.
Yes.
And can you explain that, how that might change then?
Certainly. The notes that we have are reflected in columns 5 and 6 of your table, which you're asking for targets. And that note 1 refers to, you'll see it at the bottom of the page, we were unable to come up with a target because the target is the benchmark. And the benchmark is set by the Oregon Investment Council. So our goal is to meet or beat the benchmark. So it's functionally from a performance measure standpoint, we wouldn't be saying 100% of a measure. It's the benchmark.
Okay, I'm struggling with this, so I'm going to ask Mr. Winan.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're trying to, I think, to use Senator Morse's comment, put a round peg in a square hole, or vice versa, that there aren't some, these are, the performance measures here are benchmarks that are market-driven and can move, and so there's no way you can evaluate it except maybe to have periodic reports. And maybe we could adopt the performance measures or recommend approval of them, but ask the treasurer to report to the Joint Legislative Committee on where they are in respect to the performance measures, say maybe in the third quarter of next calendar year. Are we meeting the benchmarks? Are we ahead of them? That sort of thing, because it is, the benchmarks in large measure are market driven. So
that seems to be a perfectly reasonable solution. Senator Morissette.
That's not a performance measure, though. I mean, you're doing a market driven benchmark. How are you trying to improve your service? How are you trying to prove information to the public? How are you trying to do a better job at running your agency? Those are things that.
Well, I think in some cases Treasury is using nationally normed referenced measures. Ms. Hagelin, maybe you can comment on that, because I know when we went through these in detail, particularly when you were comparing them to nationally normed reference, these were you'd be able to see trends over time rather than a fixed point in time.
Correct.
Would you comment on that?
Yes. In our Phase 1 presentation, we noted under tab 3 of our performance measures, each of those are relative to, as has been stated, market independently set rates of return. For instance, commonly known when we don't use it is the S&P 500. And we benchmark the activity of staff. So what you're seeing is the end result, the output of staff's recommendations for hiring and firing of managers adopted by the Oregon Investment Council, the performance of those actions, the realized returns, net of cost. So actually it rolls up the cost of those managers. It's reflective of our negotiating fees, our keeping our custody costs down. So those are all embedded in our net performance as it's compared to a market-driven, market-standard benchmark.
Recalling your first presentation of these performance measures, the thing that I found so attractive was that you had the opportunity to benchmark your performance against peers nationwide. Is my recollection correct?
Madam Chair, from the standpoint of we didn't have a performance measure relative to other pension funds, but other pension funds use these same benchmarks.
I said peers.
Peers.
Right.
So, for instance, State of Washington, you're saying we do not have a benchmark for that. And if I may respond to why that's a difficult comparison, is investment portfolios are structured to address the unique characteristics and risk tolerances of this pension fund. We talked earlier about the Common School Fund. State of Washington may have in their pension fund totally different dynamics of why they pick different asset classes or different benchmarks. So that comparison to peers on an absolute basis is not necessarily very helpful.
Senator Morissette.
Well, I guess we can talk about benchmark 24, which is customer satisfaction rating, and we could talk about 25, which is number of hours of education and training. I mean, those to me are what benchmarks are all about and not statistics that come from indexes and so on. I mean,
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I think it's important for the committee to understand that performance measures are a statutory requirement that direct the department to have their actions fall in line with the performance measures that they set. I spent several hours last night reading the statutes on performance measures. Yes, I have no life. I admit it. But it's interesting. These aren't just good ideas. These are, the department is setting pretty much where they see themselves operating over the next 24 months, and their actions are statutorily directed to move towards meeting those performance measures. And so I think it's important that that we have performance measures for them that help them manage, but also allow us in 24 months to come back and and say, you know, did they manage towards those performance measures?
And so based on your review of the statute and based on your review of these performance measures and having heard their level one presentation, are you satisfied that these meet those criteria?
I don't know. I mean, and that's in all fairness. The level of complexity that the treasurer's office has to deal with, I'm not trained, educated enough to know. I think I can say customer focus. And from my perspective, they do a great job. But, you know, I don't know.
Senator Morsett.
Well,
Senator Morsett.
I guess who do you consult with within your group when you establish performance measures that reflect how well you do the job? I mean, not how well your investments do, although that's part of it, but I mean, what's the what's the dynamic within your organization that needs improvement? And customer relations, I guess, is a good one, and high quality workforce. Those are both measurable. I think if you take surveys and depending on who your customers are, maybe the people that you work with in terms of the economic development aspects that we were just talking about, but I just don't see anything here that tells me that we can come back in 2 years and say, gee, what, you know, tell us how you functioned in the last 24 months and how you met your goals.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Morsett, I might again state that there is a you are seeing a difference in the measures. The last two on the page are going to our customers. I should say that the second to the last, customer satisfaction, is going to our customers and asking them for feedback.
That's a good measure.
Yes, it is. Of are we serving their needs? And our final performance measure is relative to the workforce. Are we training our staff to do their job? Those have a different characteristic to them, and we've noticed noted the agency goal there, customer focused and high quality workforce. The remainder of them are titled financial leadership, and what's different about those is the measures that we have from the Treasury's side, the Treasury input, is actually the collective result of all of our activities. So you're really seeing the output is a fairly high level capture of the activities of the agency. And I might highlight back to our phase one presentation, our measure on the comparison of the Oregon short-term fund to money market, which is now performance measure number 8. And that actually is a measure of the private sector comparison to all of our activities, our cash management and our investment activities.
I'm sorry. Can I just say something real
quick?
You have to say it in a way that we understand it, though. I mean,
okay.
Go out and get someone who is not an auditor or, I mean, not an accountant, and have them come in and help you rewrite these things so we know what the hell you're talking about. I just don't see these as measurable, understandable measures of improvement. Now, if you say in here what you just got through saying, in a way, in a written form, I think you have to rewrite these. They're probably fine, but I just don't see.
Senator Morsett, let me just interrupt here for a second. Senator Morse has a question. Senator Smith has a comment. What I'm going to suggest we do, given the shortage of time, is that when you went through these performance measures in your high-level overview, I think they were extremely relevant. They made a good deal of sense, and I think seeing them in this display without having the background material and the benefit of your explanation is perhaps not the most effective way to discuss them. So, absent any contradiction from the committee, what I'm going to recommend is that tomorrow we proceed by asking everyone to bring their original presentation books that have that level of detail in them. We'll go through them one at a time. We will devote the entire time that we're together tomorrow to going through the performance measures and then working the budget. I don't anticipate that there's going to be public testimony, and unless there is contradiction from the committee, that's how I'd like to proceed. Senator Morris and then Senator Smith. I have Representative Smith.
I concur. I do not now have a question. Thank
okay.
I think that's excellent. All I was going to point out is I know, Madam Chair, you and Senator Morris have a great piece of legislation moving forward, and maybe there's a way of tying this to that.
I'm going to add that Senator Morris and I have been working on a continuous improvement methodology. It is a bill introduced by Senator Morris, and I'm tagging along the end of it. It's SB 471. We have noticed, and I know you have a number of boards that advise you, both policy and advisory. What we are recommending for your consideration, and I'd like your comment in the morning, is to include what we're calling a best business practices measure that we're adding to all of the performance measures that ostensibly looks to have your boards engaged in some demonstrable way, your advisory boards, and that they would at a minimum demonstrate that they had looked at least quarterly at the financial statements, that they've been reviewed and approved, and undoubtedly your council already does that, that your advisory board had approved the agency's legislative package, including policy options, that the board had at least quarterly reviewed the agency's performance measures, demonstrate that your advisory board had done a annual performance review or discussion with you and other management staff, demonstrate that your board had reviewed any audit performed and or any management letters and had taken the appropriate corrective action, and to demonstrate that the board had engaged with its director in determining an improvement process in the agency that would include those activities designed to reduce costs, improve the quality of the agency's service, shorten timeline for accomplishing the agency's mission, and otherwise improve the way the agency carries out its mission, and then provide as part of the next session's presentation to Ways and Means, for lack of a better word, a governance letter indicating that the Board or Commission had discharged all of these responsibilities. While this sounds onerous in its recitation, what we're really looking for is a universal level of engagement of advisory boards. I am confident, based on my knowledge of your office, that you engage in these activities all the time. We're just asking that it be institutionalized and formalized by adding this best business practices measure to your performance measures. And so I would welcome your reflection on that. If you have questions, either discuss it with me or the professional staff or Senator Morris. This is not intended to be burdensome. It's intended to standardize across agencies the level of engagement of their boards and commissions. You are unique given the level of sophistication of the investment board and others, but I think we would still like to try to embed this kind of a best business practices in your performance measures. I think the best way for the committee to fully understand how sophisticated your performance measures are would be to bring the presentation binders tomorrow. We start with that. Work into finishing up on your budget, and I would invite you, Mr. Treasurer, I know you have your staff here to add support and technical assistance to the debate and the dialogue held by the committee. I don't think it's necessary to keep all these people away from their very important jobs, and I would ask you to use your discretion as to what of them you think are necessary to have here, and then ask the others to not be present. It's not that we don't like you, but I just know you all have important work to do, and sitting here is probably not useful. So, Mr. Treasurer, any comments before we move towards conclusion?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, appreciate that opportunity to come back tomorrow and again, go through the performance measurements, try to make it as clear as possible, and
good.
Hopefully we'll conclude
this. Is this approach acceptable to the committee, Representative Smith?
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I know I've used more than my fair share of time today. I'll leave some of it for tomorrow.
I was the only one today.
I really think there's a leadership opportunity for you, Mr. Treasurer, and in that you're recognized as the state's financial manager by everyone in the state of Oregon, including children. And I really think there's an opportunity for you to use the pulpit, if you will, of your position to help children learn how to manage cash better. And I really think this body ought to work with you somehow to help you take that leadership role in teaching children at a young age cash management in a very simple ABC type manner. And I just throw that out as a suggestion.
I think beyond cash management, just fiscal responsibility.
Well, yeah. Financial knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, that's however you want to say it, but I'd go beyond cash management. And
it's something that I'm very mindful of, that, and we all read the papers about how personal bankruptcy is an all-time high, and you know, credit card debts just accumulates so easily. You get those cards in the mail all the time. And we've taken out of the curriculum basically any finance. Home finance, how to manage cash, how to manage a bank account, investing. I mean, all those things. And I personally, this is a charge that we've been beginning to make some inroads and find some partnerships, because there's a lot of people out there who want to try to educate children on this. And I think you're right. There is a role for the charity.
I think consumer and business services is a place to try and find some help to help you do that.
Thank you.
Well, then, absent any additional comment from the committee, seeing none, I am going to carry over the public hearing and work session on House. Carrying over the work session on House Bill 5071, the budget and performance measures of the Treasurer of the State.
Thank you.
Without objection, we are adjourned, and we will.